Case number 19-3058 et al. United States of America versus Antoine White, also known as Tone Appellant. Mr. Kramer for the appellant, Ms. Gabriel for the appellee.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court.
Good morning.
Since the briefs were filed, the government's 28J letter of October 5th, 2020 has considerably narrowed the issues before the court. As far as I can tell, and obviously I don't speak for the government, but at this point, it appears that the defense and the government agree with the district court that these were covered offenses, right. So that there's an eligibility for sentence reduction. It appears that the government agrees with the defense that we both disagree with the district judge about the district judge's test about availability of relief. And the government agrees with us that that's not a proper test under the the First Step Act. And so that the only issue I think that's before the court is the district court's indication that in its discretion, it would deny the motion under the First Step Act. So I think that's unless the court has questions about, and I recognize that the majority of the briefs are devoted to the issues that now appear to be agreement between the parties. And unless the court has questions about that, I intend to just focus on the discretionary aspect.
I don't think we do. I think you should go right on to the discussion.
I hate to contradict the boss here, but.
No, that's okay. You used to be the boss.
Old habits, I guess. Okay. I do for two reasons. One, we have two very good advocates here, and I'd like to understand the First Step Act a little better. But the second point is, what do we do with the fact that two of you agree with something that the district court doesn't agree with if we don't hold that the district court was wrong? So if we were to remand it to the district court and not hold the court was wrong, simply that each of you would like to go forward, is that enough? Or could the district court, so maybe I should start with that question. Or could the district court said, well, that's all well and good, but that's not my view of the law?
No, you could remand it to the district court. I think it should be remanded, obviously, on the discretion issue. But I think the district court could say the same thing again, which is I don't think it's available. But if I exercise discretion, this is what I would do. And I think that's our argument that has to be a fuller.
I thought you were advancing the claim that the district court was wrong on the test of availability.
Yes.
The fact that the government now agrees with you doesn't change your view that you are bringing an appeal in which you are saying the district court was wrong. Government counsel now says, well, we don't disagree with that. So you would want us to say, I assume in an opinion, the district court's wrong. So when it goes back, the district court has no discretion with respect to that determination anymore if we agree with you.
Yeah, that's the question I have.
No, I think that's right, and I think it's quite actually.
Why would you even hesitate over that? I'm confused.
Well, I mean,
if we agree with you,
yes,
it seems to me straightforward that we would say in an opinion that here's the issue that was raised by the appellant. District court went the other way. They're challenging it. We agree with appellant, and incidentally, the government agrees too. District court's wrong, and on remand, that's off the table.
No, I agree with that. I don't know why I hesitated, and only in the sense that you could just say remand it to the district court and say exercise for more fulsome discussion of the discretion issue. But I think you're right, Judge Edwards. And I think that the simple answer to it is that the First Step Act has nothing about this availability issue that the district court superimposed on the statute. And the government agrees, as I said, that it's only the amounts of drugs either found, in this case, because it went to found by the jury. In a case of a plea, it would be
found by the jury or conceded.
But in this case, because it went to trial, it was not conceded, right?
All right.
The jury clearly found only on the one count of each of those that it was more than 5 grams. And that penalty has been changed, obviously.
Okay, so then if we do need to discuss this availability argument, which is the 404B argument, let me just ask you a couple of questions about
yes.
it. Yes. So what is it, what do you understand the words to mean as if sections 2 and 3 of the Fair Sentencing Act were in effect at the time? What do you understand?
Nothing more than that, frankly, just as if they were in effect. It doesn't say anything about...
Well, what does it mean? What does it mean as if they were in effect?
All I can say is, to me, it means just what it says. There's nothing that says that if you decide that the guidelines would be the same, or that you can't modify the sentence, impose a reduced sentence. Modifies the wrong word, impose a reduced sentence. It means just what it says, if they were in effect. It doesn't say anything about there has to be a lower guideline range, a lower statutory range. That's in 404A. So,
but when the judge considers whether they were in effect, as if they were in effect, do you think that means that I understood from your brief that you understood the judge may consider the judge found amounts for the in making the determination, including for the statutory range. Is that right?
No.
No.
So perhaps either I'm not understanding the brief or the brief is less clear than it might have been. I'm sure it's the former. AJ, don't worry.
I'm sure it's the latter.
So at page 28 of the brief, I'm not trying to trip you up here. I'm just trying to figure out what you mean here. It says, of course, in exercising its discretion, a judge may take stock of several considerations, including the judge found amount of crack in the conspiracy.
Yes, I'm sorry.
So what do you mean by that?
That's the stage we're at in this appeal, which is the discretionary stage. In deciding whether to actually impose a reduced sentence, the judge can consider that amount. That's not an amount the judge can, that's it. It says in exercising its discretion at page 20.
No, I understand.
Discretionary phase.
I understand that. So, but if the judge uses the judge found amount to determine in the discretionary stage and looks at the statutory penalty, that's a different question, obviously, than if the judge uses the jury found amount and looks at the statutory penalty in the discretionary phase, right? So if the judge looked at the jury found amount only in the sentencing phase, the judge would see that your defendants have already served more than the statutory penalty, which is 20 years. They've yes. served 27 years.
Yes.
If the judge looked at the judge found amount, the judge would find, I think probably the same statutory penalty, a max I'm talking about, same statutory max, right?
In the judge found amounts.
Yeah. So are you saying that they can use either one in the discretionary? Leave aside the argument about availability. That's not necessarily what I'm talking about here. I'm with you on the question of discretionary, and I'm trying to figure out what is a judge supposed to do in the discretionary phase. And at some parts of your brief, you say what I just said. You say the same thing on page 45 or something like it. I'm going to just find it. So maybe it could help both of us.
I'm sorry, which page?
Well, that one was page 28.
No, right.
The other is page 45. And that says, appellants do not seek to reopen factual disputes. In fact, they accept the judge found quantity determinations for purposes of their guidelines calculation.
Right.
So are you saying that the judge, so I'm, you maybe you don't see my, understand my confusion, but I am a little confused. At the same time, you say that Apprendi requires that the post FSA range cannot be based on judge found.
All right.
So what is it? So I'm the judge, and the DC Circuit has sent it back, and I know I can have my discretion. And the judge asks, well, can I use the jury? Must I use the jury found? If I must use the jury found, then I should release these people immediately, not just reduce because it's above their sentencing statutory max. If I look at the judge found one, then, and I decide to stay the same, then I don't reduce. So.
No, it's discretion. When you say must reduce, we concede that it's discretionary. And the judge, as part of that, the judge can consider the amount and what the guideline range would be, but it's not a disqualifying as judge, as the district.
I understand it's not disqualifying. I understand that, and I understand the government agrees with that. Now I'm just trying to figure out what is the judge supposed to do on remand. Saying the judge can look at either judge or jury found, either one?
Both, I think. I mean, one argument is that since these two men were sentenced, there's been the Apprendi decisions and the Booker, and the guidelines are advisory, but we didn't challenge the judge found amounts, but they don't affect, they're part of the equation for the judge to exercise their discretion, but they're not in any way binding on anybody.
I understand, but the judge, if the judge says, okay, look, I think I should look at the judge found amounts. I looked at the judge found amounts, sentence is still within a statutory range and still within the guidelines. So I'm going to stop here. I don't find any of the other considerations terribly relevant. That's one judge could do that. Another judge could say, I'm going to look at the jury found amounts, and my God, this is above the statutory limit and above the guidelines. So, I'm a statutory guidelines person and I'm going to follow those. And therefore I'm going to give release immediately or whatever. Are both judges acting reasonably within discretion then?
I think so, as long as they take into account all the 35.
I appreciate the other. I'm only just for the moment on quantity. Yeah.
Yes, I believe that's correct. They can consider what the jury found. They can consider what the judge found, but it's not binding on anybody. It's not a must. They could consider it. They don't have to. They can consider any factor they want under the 3553A factors. So yes, I would say both judges, as long as they did a fulsome consideration of the factors, would be proper.
So and the as if part doesn't mean that in the discretionary decision making, the judge is supposed to think about as if Apprendi applied or as if Apprendi didn't apply at the time. That is, it doesn't have to. It's within the judge's discretion.
Right. I think one factor, obviously, is that since these two men were sentenced, that the guidelines have become advisory only. Mm-hmm. The judge should consider that, it seems to me. Must they consider it? I don't think I would go that far, but it's certainly a factor that they should consider and was raised before the district court here.
All right, I'm sorry to have taken you away from your discretionary factors argument.
Okay, I will just say that for these two young men, I think their tragic childhood, Mr. White was born, his mother was 15 years old. The facts are set out in the briefs. I'm just gonna highlight a few of them. His mother was a drug addict in jail. His father was in jail. For Mr. Hicks, his parents drove away when he was 5 years old and he never saw them again and never knew what happened to them. They were raised in a neighborhood which at the time was rife with drug dealing. At the time they were sentenced, they were 20 and 23 years old. They have spent far more than half their lives in jail. They've spent 27 years in jail. The letters that were sent in their support at the appendix for Mr. White, 388 to 418, and for Mr. Hicks, 619 to 636, are incredible, the way they have mentored, the way they've rehabilitated themselves.
Is your principal argument, I'm sorry to interrupt, is your principal argument, because I think we understand what you're asserting might be mitigating factors, is your argument that the district courts simply did not account for any of them?
Yeah, the discretionary discussion in the district court's 61 page opinion was about a page and a half or 2 pages at the very end of the opinion, which all it did was recite the facts of the offense and said nothing else, said nothing about their ages. And of course the Supreme Court, they started in this when they were juveniles, and the Supreme Court has recognized recently how the young mind is unformed.
So your principal claim is the court could consider and did not, did not reasonably consider the mitigating factors. And let me ask you with respect to one, because
yes.
I think the two sides are going past each other on the obstruction. The government is pointing to something that I don't think you're claiming. I think you're claiming that the district court, in considering that obstruction, suggested that Hicks himself was involved in the murder, as opposed to what the transcript says. That is, he clearly was trying to affect that proceeding, but he himself was not involved in the murder. And so you're both talking about entirely different things. But in any event, the question I have, just out of curiosity to satisfy myself, the Supreme Court now seems, I think, to make it clear, you're claiming clearly erroneous. The government's claiming plain error with respect to something you're not claiming. You're claiming clear error on the obstruction with respect to what the district court said. And I'm assuming you're assuming that it was preserved. That is, that it was raised with the district court and responded to by the, I just looked back at the transcript, but I want to make sure I understand both sides. The government's talking about something you're not talking about, so I'm not talking about that. But with respect to what you are arguing, I think it was, and is that where you think the preservation requirement is met? The Supreme Court now seems to say, even with factual, alleged factual errors, and you're saying this is a factual error on the part of the district court, assume something about his participation in murder that was not correct, and that you're arguing that that influenced the district court, right?
So I'm a little, the district court now said, the current opinion said he was involved in a murder.
Yes,
but
yes.
Judge, I'm the sorry, original yes. sentencing judge did not
say. Did not, I understand.
So, there was no hearing on this motion. It was all done on the papers.
No, I understand, but you're claiming it was clear error.
Yes.
Okay, by reference to what? There's a transcript colloquy, is that what you're, where it was raised with the district court judge, and the district court judge, so the district court judge knew you were not raising the claim that the government thinks you were raising, which they say falls within plain error land. You were saying the district court, to the district court, he wasn't involved in the, this is not about him and murder, it's about him and trying to influence that proceeding, right?
Yes.
All right, you're saying that you're raising that with the district court, preserved the question, and the district court then got it wrong in its assumption.
Well, and then the district court in its decision said that Mr. Hicks was obstructing because of his involvement, and that was the end of the, there was no, that
I'm only asking about the preservation. I understand what you're claiming is the error, because I've been a little bit confused. Judge Silverman and I, a long time ago, said that the clearly erroneous rule from the civil side controls and no preservation is required. Supreme Court in Davis now seems to put that completely to rest. There is a preservation requirement with respect to alleged factual errors. I just want to make sure, because the government's not joining you in this discussion. You're claiming it's a clearly erroneous test, and it was clearly erroneous, as if to say you did preserve it.
Yes.
And you're claiming you raise it with the district court. The district court then went on and made a determination that was wrong. And that's all you have to do.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, could I follow up on that? I'm just, I think if the district court, relies on a fact that is not true, it has to be remanded. So I care less about this standard of review question, maybe than Judge Edwards does at this moment, but I'm not sure about the answer to his question. So you raised in your sentencing memorandum the points about rehabilitation, childhood, et cetera, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Then the district court said, erroneously in your view, in the opinion, because there was no hearing, no elocution, nothing,
right.
Said that your client Hicks, that the obstruction involved his participation in a murder, right?
Right. I think yes.
No, not just his involvement.
Participation was the word used, yes.
Yeah, something like that. And then you did not have an opportunity to respond after. That is, there was no opportunity for you to correct the record by saying, unless you filed a motion to reconsider or something, right?
Right.
I think we pointed it out in our papers, actually, that
they... Papers at the before the judge's ruling?
Yes.
In the reply brief. I think it was in your reply brief to the district court.
Yes. Yes.
What was a reply brief after? This is in response to the government misunderstanding the facts. Is that what you're saying?
In the government's opposition to the First Step Act motion.
Yes.
They argued that it was about his involvement in murder.
I see. Okay.
Right.
But it was not.
Okay. So then you joined that issue and disagreed in your reply papers with respect to the sentencing. Okay. Right. Great. All right. I understand.
So I just want to say that there was that both their age at the time, their circumstances, the incredible letters about their rehabilitation and their mentoring of people in prison, their support from their families and friends, job offers if they were released from prison. For whatever reason, I mean, there is no indication the district judge considered any of that.
And all right, Mr. Kramer, let me ask you one other question. What do you understand the district court did in its alternative holding? Did it use judge-made findings, jury-made findings of quantity, neither one, both? Did the judge, given what the judge had previously said, did the judge understand what you believe to be the law? I take it. I think the government also now believes that the judge could have used the jury found quantities.
The current district court said no, it was all the judge found quantities.
But when they said in the alternative, when the district court says in the alternative, which I take it to be some kind of even if argument, even if what? That is, When the district court ultimately applies discretion, I don't see any indication one way or the other about whether that included an acknowledgement of being able to use jury found findings.
Well, I think the judge rejected any, idea about the jury found findings at the availability stage.
Yes, but then when the judge moved on to, okay, I'm going to give an alternative holding here, essentially, right?
Right. Yeah. Well, the district court has said Elaine and Apprendi don't apply.
Yeah.
This proceeding, so clearly, the judge was using the judge-made facts, found facts.
So, is part of your argument for a remand not only the argument that you were making a moment ago, but also that the district court didn't understand that it could have relied on the jury found quantity for purposes of sentencing range and guidelines?
Absolutely. I mean, she had so to speak pretermitted that fact by finding that at the availability stage, so that it was essentially irrelevant at the discretionary stage. Yes, absolutely. That's an argument that one of the things that I said earlier, that it changed now to the advisory guidelines and that jury findings set the statutory range, would set the statutory range now. So that was.
But she didn't, Mr. Graham, she didn't say that. You're assuming that because she took it off the table at the availability stage, that when she said in the alternative, I would do X, that she must have assumed that that she couldn't rely just on jury quantity, right?
She didn't say one way or the other. You're absolutely
right. Didn't say.
Yeah. Okay.
But she.
But that's why you think it should be remanded on this issue, because we don't know the answer to that question, correct?
Yes. Yes. Okay. I think that's the point of the whole remand. All of these. Right. That was one issue we argued that she should consider that the whole sentencing structure had changed along with all these mitigating facts, and none of them are mentioned in the discretion.
All right. I think Judge Garland or Judge Edwards, do either of you have any more questions at this point?
No.
No.
Thank you.
We'll hear from the government, and I'll give you a couple minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay.
Good morning.
Ms. Pagel is now unmuted.
Can you hear me now? Yeah. Okay, good morning.
Sound like a commercial.
May it please the court, Elizabeth Gabriel on behalf of the United States. I do think, as Mr. Kramer pointed out, that we are in agreement on a lot of issues in this appeal, and that the court need not decide some of the more difficult Section 404 issues because it can't uphold the district court's judgment on the discretionary ruling. I'm happy to clear up what the government's position is if there's confusion on that, and to discuss further what we think the mechanics of a Section 404 proceeding should be, if the court would like me to address that. Otherwise, I'll just talk about the discretionary ruling.
I think we're back in the same posture that Mr. Kramer began and that we wouldn't let him stick to. So
okay.
I'm going to have to ask you to do the same.
Sure.
Tell us exactly what is the government's position now.
The government's position now is that because appellant's offenses were violations of Section 841 B1A 3 and B1B 3, that those offenses are covered offenses for purposes of Section 404 and that they were eligible for consideration for a sentence reduction. Now, we agree with appellant that the district court should not have considered the judge found quantities in determining what the statutory range would have been if sections 2 and 3 of the Fair Sentencing Act were in effect in terms of the 404B analysis. So at that phase, we think that the judge should only look at the jury found or admitted quantities. But we agree with appellant that when it comes to deciding whether to impose a reduced sentence, in considering all of the 3553A factors, the court can and should consider the totality of the conduct, including all of the total amount of drugs, whether found by the jury or not. And so at that point, the total quantity would come into consideration.
So this statement in your letter, I'm just going to try to pull it up here for 1 second, which says the position of the Department of Justice is that Section 404B contemplates determination of the statutory penalty range based on the quantity of crack cocaine reflected in the jury verdict or admitted by the defendant at a guilty plea. You mean that only with respect to this argument about availability and not with respect to the way in which the judge acts in the judge's discretion?
Exactly. So once a defendant is deemed eligible because he has committed a covered offense, the district court has to figure out how sections 2 and 3 of the Fair Sentencing Act would have affected his sentence. In other words, what the statutory range would have been had the Fair Sentencing Act been in effect. In reaching that that determination, that question, the court looks not at judge found quantities, but only at jury found or admitted quantities. So we think that the judge found quantities should not be relied upon in determining the applicable statutory range. But then once that is set, the court has to decide in its discretion whether a reduction is warranted.
Well, I have the same confusion I'm afraid I had with Mr. Kramer. So if you have to use the jury found quantities in determining the sentencing range, when you go to discretion, we're above the jury found, we're above the sentencing range now under the jury found quantities. So what is the district court supposed to do at that point? That would seem like the district court, yes, has discretion, but should realize that the person has served longer than the statutory range. And in which case, maybe it would be an abuse of discretion not to release the person. Why is that wrong?
Well, I think simply because the total quantity would elevate the guidelines range, for example, above the new statutory range, doesn't mean that a court abuses its discretion if it decides not to grant the reduction. Once the court determines...
Wait, when you say reduction from what? Because the statutory range is below the guideline range.
Right, a reduction from the sentence that was originally imposed. Ultimately the court has to consider the totality of the circumstances, all of the factors under 3553, the court can weigh those factors differently. It may decide that, well, the total quantity of drugs doesn't outweigh other considerations, or as in this case, the court concluded that the nature and circumstances of the offense do outweigh other considerations. And so in the court's discretion, a reduction wouldn't be warranted.
So, to answer Judge Garland, you're essentially hypothesizing district court judge looks at a case and said, these folks under the statutory range should be released. But I now am going to exercise discretion to increase what appears to be the statutory range. And the reason I'm doing it is that what you're saying? In other words, it's not a matter of whether it's being reduced. What you're positing is the judge wants to exercise discretion to reach this result to see whether the sentence should be increased above the statutory range.
Well, we wouldn't look at it that way.
As a real life matter, that's what you, this really is a little bit more perplexing than I realized. That's essentially what you're saying. If we look at it as of assuming the statute was in place and you're agreeing that statutory range, you have to take what the jury found. Statutory range now is exceeded. They've done their time. So the question before the district court now is, do I enhance? And if so, why? And the other side's arguing, not only don't we think you should enhance, we think there were reasons to go lower. So wait, how are we resolving this mismatch?
Well, I think that the critical factor here is that under Section 404, any reduction is discretionary. Defendants are not entitled to reductions.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I got to make sure I'm following. When you say any reduction, remember, I'm having trouble with the word reduction now.
Oh, let me see if I can help for a minute. I understand you, Gabriel, to be referring to 404C, which says nothing in this section shall be construed to require a court to reduce any sentence pursuant to this section.
Yes.
So the reduce you're talking about is to reduce from the original sentence.
From the original sentence.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I'm sorry if that was unclear. Yeah.
Okay. No, I want to make sure. Remembered C, but I want to make sure that's what you were talking about. Okay.
Yes.
I'm sorry for interrupting.
Yeah. The way I conceptually think about this is sort of in a two-step process, but it ultimately is a discretionary decision. And because...
To reduce from the original sentence.
From the original. Exactly. Okay. Because defendants are not entitled to reductions under the First Step Act. The court has considerable discretion to consider the nature and circumstances of their offense.
And does the court have the, so as I understood Mr. Kramer's position, the judge has discretion to either look at judge found quantities or jury found quantities or both. You agree with that as well?
Once the statutory range is determined, yes.
I think that's correct.
We would, of course, the government would argue that the judge should look at the full range of conduct.
Right. But do we know whether the district court in this case knew that it had that ability? Because, you know, given the shifting views of the, I'm not blaming the government about this, but given the, you know, the changing views and the judge's sort of first two steps of the analysis, this is really the question I put to Mr. Kramer before. Do we need to remand at least, leaving aside Mr. Kramer's other arguments, which you'll get a chance to respond to in a second. But sorry, Mr. Kramer, but it's really good on Zoom. I can see your facial expressions perfectly. is it, and I think as Judge Tatel put it, it's pretty hard to know what the district court thought, because that at that point of the district court's opinion, it's only about the exercise of discretion. There's no discussion of quantity.
Right. Well, I think that the court's opinion is very detailed, obviously, and very lengthy and well-reasoned. And the court
Gabriel, not on this issue. It's
Well, I do want to just explain why I think a remand isn't necessary. Right. The court starts out her written decision by discussing the views of appellants and recognizes that appellants consider their new statutory range to be 0 to 20. And that's how the court sort of frames the discussion. Now, Chief Judge Howell goes on to explain why she disagrees with appellant's view.
Take this into account in answer to the question my two colleagues raised. And this court judge references the quantity in the discretionary portion of the opinion. She's referencing only the judge found quantity, only. So my assumption was she is not assuming that the jury found is in play at all. There's nothing to indicate that she either bought it or realized it at all. The only thing she references in the discretionary part is the judge found quantities, right?
That's correct, but I do want to explain why I think she considered the appellant's position, because goes through what she thinks Section 404 means and how it should be applied, she then says, well, even if I'm wrong, essentially, even if appellants are entitled to relief here, even if relief is available, and implicit in that assumption is that, you know, even if I'm wrong about Apprendi and Alain, that I still would not grant a reduction. So I think that
You know what I read her to be saying on that point? The even if, I thought she was saying, doesn't matter because they're not going to do any better. And they're not going to do any better because she's assuming the judge made quantities control. I thought the thrust of her opinion, you know, what waste time and discretion, they're not going to do any better because when I look at the judge made quantities, they're in the same place. That's the way I read her opinion. I did not see anything to suggest that she understood they would be better off if she used the jury determination, and she was rejecting that too.
Well, the way that I understood it, Your Honor, was that she, in that, you know, her even if, even assuming language is a reference to even assuming that I was wrong in how to calculate the statutory range, mm-hmm. I still, and in other words, even if appellants are right, that in fact they are entitled to consideration for a 0 to 20 sentence, I still, considering the 3553A factors, would not grant a reduction. So yes, she refers to the judge found quantity in that section, but only as part of her 3553A analysis.
But you agree that the reading that I'm suggesting is as plausible as your reading of the district court, right? Because she's only referring to the judge made. And the worst or best that we come away with is we're really not sure. Right?
Well, I agree with you that she only refers to the judge found quantity, but I don't think that it means that she misunderstood her discretion.
We don't even have to go that far. If the appellate court really is not sure with the district court judge, I don't have to go further than that. If I can honestly say the view you're propounding, I get it, but the view that's in my head, I get too, and I don't know which way to come out. If I'm confused, where does it go? It goes back.
I understand Your Honor's point, and again, the government's position is that we don't think that there's a lack of clarity in the decision, but I do understand the point you're making.
Okay, thank you.
I can turn to I would like to comment on the obstruction issue, if the court would permit me.
Before you do that, Ms. Gabriel, let me just ask you, my internet was breaking up when you were responding to Judge Edwards' question about where he said, look, if I can't tell what she did, it has to go back. I heard you say, I understand, but did you go further and say, did you say what you think about that?
Why isn't
he right about that?
The government doesn't believe that there's a lack of clarity in the court's opinion.
Correct. I know that, but if the court thinks there's a lack of clarity, isn't Judge Edwards right about that?
I suppose if the court thinks that the district court could not have properly exercised its discretion because it didn't understand the mechanics of Section 404, a resentencing or a reduction of sentence, then yes, the court would be appropriate. Okay. To set the record straight.
Okay,
I just want to be
really clear about that. We don't have to conclude that she misunderstood.
Right.
All we have to conclude, I hear you agreeing with Judge Edwards, is that we can't tell one way or the other. I understand your position is that it is clear, but you know, you're a good lawyer, you're arguing your case, but if we think if we read it and think there is uncertainty, then you agree it does have to go back. And that to do that, we don't have to find that the district court misunderstood this, right? It's just uncertain.
Right. I think that's correct. If there's uncertainty, a remand would be appropriate.
Okay. Yeah. Ms., thank you very much. That's very helpful. Why don't you go on to the other issues now?
Okay. Quickly on the obstruction issue. I did not read appellant's reply brief as addressing whether this issue of whether the grand jury was investigating Mr. Hicks for murder. The reply brief, as I read it, makes clear what murder was at issue. But the PSR indicated that the grand jury, that the witness whom Mr. Hicks bribed was investigating White and Hicks for a murder. And so I think the district court was entitled to rely on that representation. And I don't think that it was preserved in this Section 404 proceeding. Once the district court ruled, I think it was incumbent upon appellants to raise an objection, either through a motion to reconsider, a motion to correct, in some form or fashion.
You haven't raised that.
We argue that plain error applies because—
No, you're arguing plain error applies with respect to something they're not asserting.
And maybe I misunderstand.
That clear. They're not asserting what you're claiming. They are claiming that the district court misunderstood in characterizing the obstruction charge, misunderstood in the sense that the district court assumed that this was about a murder that Hicks was involved in, not a murder investigation, or that he did something bad in connection with a murder investigation.
Right.
It was as if to suggest that Hicks himself was the subject, and they're saying that's not correct, and the district court shouldn't have assumed that, and that would have affected the district court's thinking if she really assumed that that's what was going on.
Right, but I think that claimed factual error, which is underlying the district court's decision, is a claim that should have been brought up.
Oh, I thought in the transcript, and I mean, I will certainly go back, but just so you understand what I'm assuming, in that colloquy with the district court, I thought that the...
Wait, I'm sorry, Judge Edwards, I don't have a transcript. What colloquy?
I can't find the pick.
I don't think there was there was no transcript in a 404.
There was. I'll have to look for the citation, and I'll tell you what I'm talking about, okay?
Okay. Either counsel, was there there was no oral discussion. There was before Judge Green, but not in this case.
Yeah. Right. And I think that even if I know that at the sentencing hearing, Mr. Hicks's counsel, made a statement, a general statement, that he wasn't involved in any murders. I don't think that preserves a claim in this Section 404 proceeding, however.
What about the district court's opinion in the 1993 opinion, in which the court says, this isn't trying to discuss the unavailability problem with respect to hearsay, that as to Hicks, you can't use the hearsay because he wasn't involved in causing the unavailability, namely the murder.
Well,
isn't that a finding by the district court that, which is by Judge Green, opposite to the decision in this case, which says that they were investigating him for murder.
Right.
Right. I think that the distinction is that statement refers to, is a general statement about his involvement, actual involvement in the murder. But what's at issue here is whether the district court erred in finding that the grand jury was investigating him for his involvement in murder. And
no,
we don't.
I think that's where you're misjoined. I didn't read them to me making that argument, but in any event, okay. I'm trying to find the pages. Go ahead.
Okay. As I understand it, they object to the district court's ruling in this case because the district court's finding as to obstruction, his obstructive behavior, was based on the assumption that he had bribed, or on the finding that he had bribed a witness who went to the grand jury, and this is what the district court's written opinion states, withholding information from the grand jury that was investigating him for murder. So the critical question here is, as I understand appellant Hicks to frame it, is whether the grand jury was investigating him for murder. And I don't think that anything in the proceedings in 1993 or in the Section 404 proceedings preserves their objection to that factual finding here. Again, this distinction I'd like to make is we're looking at what was the subject of the grand jury investigation. In any event, we don't think it matters because ultimately the district court was relying on his obstructive conduct, and appellant Hicks doesn't dispute that he in fact bribed a witness who was going to the grand jury. And that's really what was the critical conduct that the district court in this proceeding relied on in finding that a reduction in sentence was not warranted.
Ms. Gabriel, if we think, going back to the first question, if we think that there is uncertainty about the question of whether in the district judge, if we think there's uncertainty about what whether the district judge thought she could rely on, had to rely just on jury found, do we have to address this issue for Hicks? Doesn't this go back on that too for him?
I think that's true, yes.
Yeah, okay, all right. Thank you.
Okay, if the court has no further questions.
I don't have any, the only thing I just want to make sure, just as I did with Mr. Kramer, that I understand the government's position in sum, and that is that the violations here are covered, the 404B discretionary reduction is available. And in that discretionary decision-making, the judge can use either judge found or jury found amounts. Although, of course, you would argue that she should use the jury found, but in terms of permissibility, it would be permissible to use either one. Is that right?
Yes, just with the just to clarify, that's after the statutory sentencing range is determined under the Fair Sentencing Act.
So does it have to be determined, or does the judge have to announce this is the new statutory range, or is it just a question of whether the act applies? I didn't realize there was a step where it's required to actually have the judge make some determination.
Well, 404B requires the court to figure out how the Fair Sentencing Act would have affected the sentence. The term as if, you know, this phrase as if sections 2 and 3 of the Fair Sentencing Act were in effect requires the district court to figure out what that effect would have been. And so because a court can't impose a reduced sentence unless it makes that determination. Otherwise, any reduction would not be as if sections.
Right. So then your view is that in making that as if determination, the judge has to use the jury found to determine the range, and then thereafter can use either one in its discretion.
Yes.
Got it.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. Mr. Kramer, you can have 2 minutes.
Since it's on your side, would you please do me the favor of, I can't find the pages right now. They're in the 404, and I thought it was in the context of the 404B proceeding. Where did the judge misstate the matter, in your view, with respect to the obstruction? And where did defendant say something to suggest you got it wrong, Your Honor?
So at page 59 of the district court's opinion, it says Hicks engaged in obstructive conduct to withhold information from the grand jury that was investigating him for murder.
That's what I remembered. All right.
What I would like to point you to is appendix page 282, where the government, this is from the government to Judge Green, saying what the obstruction of justice was for Mr. Hicks was, he bribed Mr. Hicks, I believe he said, means Mr. Jackson. He bribed not to give information to the grand jury in the form of money and crack. They don't say a word about murder there, which clearly they would have, if about Mr. Hicks being involved in murder. That's
Mr. Kramer, is this a direct response to the question of whether the grand jury was investigating him for murder? I understand the government's position to be, okay, the obstruction count may be different. Okay, the district court may ultimately have made a decision that Hicks wasn't involved. But the only question here is, was the grand jury investigating him for murder? And do we know one way or the other about that?
The defense lawyer had given a talk about how Mr. Hicks was not involved in any murders or violence.
But what about whether he was being investigated? That I understood was the government's question.
Right, and the defense lawyer said it had nothing to do with Mr. Hicks being involved in any murder. And this was the response to that by the government, that the bribery on page 282. I just want to say two more things. The mitigation here is extremely powerful, and the Supreme Court has said in Pepper that a defendant has a right to have post-sentencing rehabilitation considered when there's a resentencing procedure. There's no indication the judge considered any of the mitigating circumstances, and that her decision on how the jury found facts were irrelevant. It was the judge found facts that would drive the guidelines range and the statutory range, seemingly colored her view of the discretionary phase. And then I just want to say one last thing. It's extremely important, especially in this case, to be certain, because under the First Step Act, the defendant only gets one shot at it. They are precluded from filing a second First Step Act motion. They're precluded from any relief by Section C, which says if a previous motion was made and denied after a complete review of the motion on the merits. I guess our argument is that this wasn't a complete review, but in any event, it's extremely important because they cannot have another chance to file another First Step Act motion the way it's currently written. Thank you very much. We would ask you to
Okay. Raise
for further consideration. Thank you.
Mr. Kramer, Ms. Gabriel, thank you both. The case is submitted.